It was a number of decades ago. I won't tell you how many. While I was finishing up my degree work at Spertus College of Judaica in Chicago, I was in a course. And as part of that course, a rabbi by the name of Munford Harris was talking about Purim. And he described it as picturing a topsy-turvy world. And out of respect for him, let me change the title somewhat of the drash for tonight. Making sense out of a topsy-turvy world. Or in other words, in an upside-down world, so God, where are you? Today concluded the celebration of Purim. It's a festival that is commanded by the Book of Esther. But this biblical holiday, let me suggest to you, is one of the strangest of all of our holidays. However, it celebrates the rather miraculous victory of the Jewish people in the Persian Empire over their enemies, over those who wanted to annihilate them just because they were Jews. It was Haman's hatred for the Jews that was a major motivation of his, pardon me, for the abuse of his power, as it was for his ancestors. And yet, amazingly, the Book of Esther does not mention God anywhere in the text. Oh, and by the way, this sort of ties in with something Richard said. Scholars are now able to identify Ahasuerus in secular sources, and Esther can be identified there as well. It should remind us that the texts with which we interact are, in fact, historically reliable accounts. But at this point, you should be saying, but wait just a minute. Didn't you just say that God is not mentioned in the book, in the Megillah of Esther, at all? Questions, 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 so many questions. Why does the name of God not appear at all in the whole Megillah, especially when it's so prominent throughout the whole of the Bible? Is it the incident of the golden calf that's the text for tonight? Is that the reason why God didn't show up to celebrate that first Purim? Or was it something like Elijah in challenging the other gods, Baal, on Mount Carmel, said, well, maybe he's off doing other things. If you read that text, you'll find out what some of those other things are, but not for tonight. Questions. So, where in the world is Carmen Sandiego? And by the way, while we're asking questions, where's Waldo? Seriously, where's God when we need him? After all, as we set the stage, the Persians are about to annihilate the Jews, all Jews within their reach. And that reach was very considerable at that time. That was the empire of the day. So you'd think it might just be a really good time for God to show up, no? The whole world seems to be upside down, but he's nowhere to be found. So God, where are you? Well, to start with, the Book of Esther emphasizes that God is real and that his purposes will occur even though he may be hidden from sight. And often we can't easily, at those times, trace his activity. Yes, the Book of Esther does not mention God, not even once. And yet his sovereignty over and his faithfulness to his people is very clear. The scroll clearly shows evil rising up against God's stated purposes. And the evil is defeated in a last-minute coming together of incredible events that need someone to cause it all to happen. No coincidences, my friends, could have brought about these events, could have brought these events together as they unfold in this book. A Jewish girl winning the pagan royal beauty pageant, the king's growing great love for her, Mordecai being at the right place at the right time to hear the plot against the king's life, Esther's life and death gamble with the Persian royal law that paid off, the last-minute canceling of the genocide against the Jewish people, the last-ditch attempt of Haman to plead with Esther for his life, a pleading which actually led to his hanging. There's just too many events that perfectly unfold. And at just the right time and just the right place. It hints at a divine plan that just begs to be discovered as the person who is the reader reads through the book. And the book is put together, let me suggest, almost humorously. Everything seems upside down, and if it's not upside down, it gets turned upside down. And just when you thought you were in the upside down, you're no longer in the upside down. You're in the upside down of the upside down. Are you upside down yet? That's the feel. We may not see God at all, but oh, is he ever there? There to save Israel, his people at the very last minute. When we read the book of Esther, it is certainly evident that there is a directing power behind every event in the book. Every detail is connected to the detail before it and influences the events after it in the ongoing story that we have here. Every action of any of the players directly leads to the results that follow. And in the end, just when everything looks hopeless and lost, but not until everything looks hopeless and lost, and the Jews are about to be exterminated from the whole of the Persian Empire, quick aside, that means Jews would have been exterminated everywhere because there were no Jews outside the Persian Empire. Okay, now that we've got that detail filled in, back to our story. Just as the Jews are about to be exterminated from the whole Persian Empire, the tables turn, and the Jews are saved and their enemies fall. Even Haman himself and all of his family are hung on the very gallows that he specifically had prepared for Mordecai. Of course, the heroine of the story is Queen Esther, or in the Hebrew, Hadassah. It's an interesting part of the story that Esther, a name, by the way, very closely related to the Hebrew term for hidden. It's an interesting part of the story that Esther was hiding her Jewish identity and living in the palace of the king. With her identity hidden, she became the king's most beloved queen. Now, Haman did not know that inside the palace, and in fact in the king's very bedroom, was a Jewish queen when he put together his plot against the Jewish people. And only at the decisive hour, just before the Jews he hated were to be exterminated from the whole empire, only then does Esther reveal her origin and asks for the king's cancellation of the royal decree against her own people. Talk about twists and turns. And for Haman, what a series of unfortunate events. It's like some wild fairy tale that works out in a very upside-down world. Several years ago, Jack experienced something similar. He was about 72 years old and just loved to fish. He was sitting in his boat one day when he heard a voice say, "Pick me up." And so he looked around, couldn't see anyone. So he thought he was dreaming when he heard the voice again, "Pick me up." Well, he looked into the water, and there floating on the top was a frog. So naturally, Jack asked, "You talking to me?" The frog said, "Yes, of course I'm talking to you. Pick me up and kiss me, and I'll turn into the most beautiful woman you've ever seen, and I'll be your bride." At this, Jack looked at the frog for a short time, reached over, picked it up very carefully, and put it in his shirt pocket. At which point the frog said, "What? Are you nuts? Didn't you hear what I said? I said, kiss me and I will be your beautiful bride." So Jack opened up his pocket, looked at the frog, and simply said, "Nah, at my age, I'd rather have a talking frog." Hey, it's Purim. It's a real twist. What did you expect? So, Purim represents a clear biblical theme of sudden reversal, just when you don't expect it, but when you need it. When God suddenly turns everything upside down, we've talked about this before several months ago, a eucatastrophe. If you don't know what that means, get the recording from several months ago. Now, some people have suggested that the only difference between a tragedy and a comedy is the ending. Well, the book of Esther is written in the classic style of a comedy. The whole tragedy is turned upside down. Everything is turned on its head. Haman is hanged on the enormous gallows he himself built. The Jewish people are saved from the Persians while thousands of Persians convert to Judaism and become Jews. And a Jewish girl becomes the queen of what is now, ready, modern-day Iran. The irony of the book should be clearly evident. And yet our sages, the rabbis of old, indicate that this is just what it will be like with the coming of the Messiah. It will be a sudden reversal, to quote the sages. When Mashiach comes, he will come in an instant, and things will be turned upside down in a second, just like Purim. Just like Purim, when the text that Matt read tells us, when their sorrow was turned into joy and their mourning into a day of celebration. As an aside, speaking of sudden reversals and unexpected twists and turns, I was reading something that Rabbi Dr. David Friedman wrote a couple years ago. So I quote him. Dr. Patrice Fisher has written a brilliant analysis of the book of Esther, comparing it to the closing sections of the book of John, another amazing story in which everything gets suddenly turned upside down. If you're interested in obtaining a copy, please contact Menorah Ministries at Menorah Ministries, www.menorahministries.com, end quote. That was a legitimate quote, by the way. So if you're interested, go get it. So what are the lessons of Purim for us today? That's another question. Let me share a small handful. God sometimes allows threats to go almost to their very end before he intervenes and saves the day. His sense of timing is very different from ours. And even at the very last minute, when everything seems to be a total loss, it's still never too late for God to intervene and save the day. So don't give up and don't stop praying and don't give up hope, even under the most impossible of circumstances. Even if you face the sea in front of you, like our people did just a couple weeks ago in the reading, even if you face the sea in front of you and the enemy is closing in behind you, God is still sovereign. And at that seaside, in 1 minute, he can reverse the tide of history. Come on, people, you can at least smile at that pun. He can reverse the tide of history and save you from your circumstances or your situation. Another thing we can learn is that the tools and means that God has in his hand or hands are endless and often unexplainable. When God promises, we know his promises will become reality, although none of us knows how and when that will take place. What normally happens is this. We strain and suffer and stress, and then we strain and suffer and stress some more. But in the end, God's plans and promises will become a reality in his time and on time. Another thing we can learn is that it's important to do the right things. Mordecai did a good deed for the king, and it was written down on the king's books and then quickly forgotten. And after a long time, though, Mordecai was paid well for the good that he did. In contrast, we often want to see the rewards immediately, and we want to have recognition and honor and reward for the good that we do now. However, it might be wise for us to realize that God is a just rewarder. Doing the right thing is always right and good, and allowing God to keep the books is the best way to make sure that we will receive, at the right time, the reward from him. And then there's another more complicated lesson to be learned from this book, so stick with me on this one. There may be times when what is done might seem or look wrong or even dishonest to some people. Like when Mordecai teaches Esther to hide her identity as a Jew and sends her to the palace of a pagan king. Now, many people would probably criticize Mordecai and Esther for doing these things. But God used these, what we might consider very gray areas, and used these people and what they did. So perhaps we should be a little slower to judge the deeds and the motives of others and to condemn people before we see the end results of their deeds. We often are far too quick to judge others, especially when we don't know what is going on behind the scenes. And in the book of Esther, what is going on behind the scenes? God in the book of Esther is working behind the scenes. and is using his people to accomplish his purpose as they do the things that they ought to be doing. And we're actually watching, as it were, from the balcony. Which brings me back to the original question regarding the book of Esther. Where, God, are you? Well, as it turns out, the name of God does appear hidden, as in the term Esther, in the book of Esther, in five different places. It just appears acrostically. First letter of this word, first letter of the next word, and so forth. If you don't understand, I'll write it out for you. And then as you read the scroll of Esther, each column of the scroll, with the exception of the first, starts with this word, Hamelech, the king. And who do you think is the king? God is. He is sovereign, even though he may not be seen. He's there, definitely behind the scenes, as the acrostic reminds us. So even though there is no express reference to God in Esther, he is clearly and pervasively present. His apparent absence tells us that he works even when he's not recognized. So through the natural course of human events and through human beings and the actions of people, God providentially preserves his people. He does it without a miraculous intervention or by a big dramatic display. He works behind the scenes quietly. And that's the pattern for the way God works throughout history. You know the poem. And if you've heard it too often, I'm sorry, but it's worth hearing again in this context. One night, a man had a dream. He dreamed he was walking along the beach with the Lord. Across the skies flashed scenes from his life. For each scene, he noticed two sets of footprints in the sand, one belonging to him and the other to the Lord. When the last scene of his life flashed before him, he looked back at the footprints in the sand. He noticed that many times along the path of his life, there was only one set of footprints. He also noticed that it happened at the very lowest and saddest times in his life. Well, that really bothered him, and he questioned the Lord about it. As we put it, so God, where are you? Lord, you said that once I decided to follow you, you'd walk with me all the way. But I noticed during the most troublesome times in my life, there's only one set of footprints. I don't understand why, just when I needed you most, you would leave me. The Lord replied, my precious child, I love you and would never leave you. During your times of trial and suffering, when you see only one set of footprints, it was then that I carried you. But as important, as powerful as that is, there is a PS to this that I read recently. It goes like this. We never do walk alone. Even in our most difficult hours, God is there to carry us through, even though perhaps behind the scenes. But many people suffer from poverty and hunger and need the support of others, of caring friends who can help ease their burden. We are called to reach out and help our brothers and sisters in time of need. Mordecai and Esther were there at the right time. God was there too. Where are you? Take a minute or so to reflect and respond in quiet, and then we will continue.